This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalbank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
This month we've got an interesting question from Joe Stainton, who's written in to us to say, I've seen, as I'm sure most people have, pictures of our galaxy. I've also seen pictures of the spiral arm where the Earth sits, usually with a circle superimposed and some text which states confidently, you are here. My question is, how can this be? Who or what has been far enough out to take these photographs? If these pictures are an approximation or a best guess to the structure of our galaxy, then again, how do we know what our galaxy should look like without being thousands of light years away from it to see? That's an excellent question, Joe. I'm sure you're right. We all see lots of what are actually artist's impressions, largely, of our Milky Way galaxy, showing the location of the sun. We clearly can't fly away in a spacecraft far enough to sort of look back and take a photograph and say where we are. So obviously they're based on some sort of observational model of the structure of the galaxy. Now, I think if we're going to answer this question, probably one of the things we should say is the Milky Way, just to cut to the chase, the Milky Way is actually a disc-like shape. We're very sure that it's a disc-like shape. So a flattened disc, imagine two dinner plates put face to face, and that's where most of the stars are. Most of the dust in the Milky Way, and it's where the sun sets. And we think about two thirds of the way out from the center of that disk, lying in the plane of the disk. Surrounding that disk, there is a larger sort of perhaps roughly spherical halo, which contains old globular clusters of stars. It also contains throughout that whole region, there's lots of dark matter, we believe. But generally, most of the stars and the dust are in this flattened disk. Now, to get an idea of what our galaxy might be like, of course, one thing we can do is look at other galaxies. And we can look out into space and we can look at all the different types of galaxies. Look at a project like Galaxy Zoo, for example, at the moment, which is looking at lots of different types of galaxies. And we can sort of compare what we see there to some of the observations we can make of our own galaxy and sort of try to work out what type of galaxy we sit in. And perhaps one of the things to note, first of all, is that if we look at sort of all sky pictures, where we go and we say take photographs of the whole sky around us, surrounding the Earth, the full sphere around us, then we see that the Milky Way is this sort of brightish band of stars that encircles the sphere, and sort of threaded through that band of stars are dust lanes which absorb the visible light from those stars. So there's some excellent pictures, like for example the two mass survey of the sky. That's the 2-micron all sky survey. 2 microns is the wavelength. That's 2 millionths of a meter, 2 microns, in the near infrared. And there's a lovely photograph of the sky there that shows this sort of the band of stars, the near infrared light from the stars, but also shows that dust lane running through it. Now that picture looks remarkably like photographs, images we can take of other galaxies at very large distances from ours, which are also disk galaxies, but seen edge on. Other galaxies are viewed at random orientations to us, so we can see them edge on or we can see them face on. If we see them face on, we might be lucky to see beautiful spiral arm patterns. If we see them edge on, then what we see is this thin strip with the dust lane running along the middle. And so there's examples of edge on galaxies that look very like our own galaxy filling the whole sky because we are inside it. So that's a very good clue, I would say, that we live inside a disk galaxy. Now, if we go back, historically, of course, go back to the time of Copernicus, you know, when it was first realized that, the sun and the Earth didn't lie at the center of the universe as it was previously thought, you know, from that time in the sort of 1500s, 1600s, if we sort of like move forward to the point of sort of saying, okay, well, we now know that the sun isn't at the center of the universe, but where is the sun located relative to other things in the universe? Well, there was a big debate going on about whether our Milky Way galaxy was all there was, whether the universe was just consisted effectively of our galaxy. And things like the Andromeda galaxy, which, you know, you can see with the unaided eye, as a fuzzy patch, and with it through a telescope, you start to see that it's basically one of these disks seen inclined at a bit of an angle to the line of sight. So it looks sort of roughly elliptical. You can even see some spiral structure in these galaxies and others, like, the Whirlpool galaxy, for example. The debate was whether those spiral nebulae, as they were called, were actually, you know, fuzzy nebulous objects within our own galaxy, inside our own galaxy, or whether they were galaxies in their own right, well outside the Milky Way. And there was a famous so-called Great Debate in 1920 between two astronomers called Shapley and Curtis. And this debate was all about the distances to these so-called spiral nebulae. That whole debate was sort of had been thrown into confusion actually by the observation of an explosion of a nova in Andromeda. So in this Andromeda galaxy, in 1885, which was given the name S and S, the letter S as a variable star and for the constellation of Andromeda. And what was done was to use sort of standard candle estimates, so to look at the brightness of this nova, and therefore to estimate its distance. So if it appeared fainter, it would therefore be farther away. And the sort of calibration they had for those techniques at the time put the distance to the Andromeda Nebula, the Andromeda Galaxy as we know it now, well within the Milky Way. So it looked like these spiral nebulae were indeed inside the Milky Way. So the scale of the universe was completely wrong here. That whole process didn't get sorted out for a few years, actually. That was the late 1800s. When you get into the 1910s, there was quite a lot of progress made because, first of all, Henrietta Leavitt worked on looking at variable stars in the large and small Magellanic clouds. And she was the first to notice that so-called Cepheid variables had varied in brightness periodically. And she realized there was a relationship between the period and the intrinsic luminosity, the intrinsic brightness of the stars. We call it a period luminosity relation. So this was really a major step forward, because it meant that you could monitor one of these variable stars, you could measure the period of its variations in brightness, and you could, having measured the period, you could therefore go to your calibration and you could say, okay, well, that tells me how intrinsically bright it is. And therefore, by looking at how apparently bright it is, I can tell how far away it is. You know, the fainter it would appear, the farther away it would be. So it was a sort of independent distance estimator. So one of the astronomers involved in the Great Debate was Harlow Shapley. And he made a survey of globular clusters of stars in our Milky Way galaxy. So these are these beautiful, almost spherical distributions of maybe something like a million stars. And he used various techniques, including the Cepheid variable technique, to estimate the distances. And when he did that, he could actually look around on the sky at about 70 or so of these globular clusters, and he could sort of get the distance away from us and the direction in which they were away from us, and therefore make a sort of 3D model of the distribution of globular clusters. And what he found was they weren't equally distributed about the sun. They all lay off in a general direction towards roughly the constellation of Sagittarius, and they lay sort of above and below the plane of the Milky Way, that was the bright band of stars that runs across the sky, and they appeared to roughly distribute themselves about a point which, at the time when he did these calculations and published his papers back in 1918, he obtained a distance to the point about which these clusters were symmetrically distributed of 13 kiloparsecs, about 13,000 parsecs. So remember, a parsec's about 3 light years. So he was the first, actually, really, to definitively show that the sun was not, say, at the centre of the Milky Way, for example. So, you know, we'd moved on from the original thoughts that the sun was at the centre of everything, and now we were able to actually show that the Milky Way was this sort of disc-like thing, and the sun was, as we say, something like roughly two-thirds of the way out from the middle. So those sort of early optical observations of, say, globular clusters and other star clusters and other star-forming regions started to give us a pretty good idea of the structure of our galaxy. But there was another breakthrough that was made that led us to sort of take another huge step forward in understanding our Milky Way and indeed other galaxies. And it really came about as a result of the development of radio astronomy in the 1930s. So when Karl Jansky first detected radio waves coming from outer space, he didn't really do much with that discovery as in terms of astronomy. Grote Reber followed on later in the 1930s to actually start to do some astronomy, and he built a radio telescope in his back garden, and he mapped the whole of the sky, or a large part of the sky, in radio waves, and showed this sort of radio emission came roughly from the same region as the Milky Way. And he published those results in the Astrophysical Journal. Now, a few years after those results were published, that paper eventually made its way into occupied Holland during World War II, and to the Leiden Observatory, which at the time the director was a gentleman called Jan Oort, who you may know from the Oort cloud of comets. And what Oort realized was reading this paper, obviously this was an incredible thing. It was the birth of invisible astronomy. It was the first time that we'd ever seen the universe at wavelengths other than the wavelengths of visible light. And what was one of the interesting things about the radio waves was that they actually passed through the dust clouds. So where we've talked about these dust clouds between the stars, which, you know, when we look at our own Milky Way, we see threaded through the disk of, through the sort of band of the Milky Way light from stars, is this sort of dark regions, which is blocking our view, the dust clouds blocking our view of more distant stars. In the radio, we'd be able to see through those dust clouds, and so we'd be able to get a much better picture of the structure of the Milky Way and peer indeed right down towards the centre of the galaxy itself. Obviously, Oort was excited about this, and he also realised that if it was possible to find what's called a spectral line at radio wavelengths, and we would be able to make even greater discoveries. Now, a spectral line is basically something where the light comes out at a very particular wavelength, a very specific wavelength. So famous examples in the visible regime, probably the most famous spectral line is called H-alpha. So you're probably aware of H-alpha filters, which are used to look at the light from the sun. H-alpha is a line that results from hydrogen atoms, where an electron in the hydrogen atom changes energy levels and either absorbs or emits a photon of a particular wavelength, about 656 nanometers in the red part of the visible spectrum. Now, what Oort was realizing was interesting here was what you can do with a spectral line is you can measure the wavelength at which you see it, and you can compare that wavelength to the wavelength at which it should appear based on your knowledge of atomic physics. So what happens is that if the source of that radiation is either moving towards you or moving away from you, then you get a shift in the wavelength of the light that you see. So you get a red shift, it's shifted to longer wavelengths as the light is stretched effectively by the source moving away from you, or it's shifted to shorter wavelengths if the object is moving towards you, a so-called blue shift. So it's actually possible to observe sources with spectral lines and determine how fast they're moving towards or away from you, which is quite an amazing thing to be able to do. And here, he realised, if there was a spectral line in the radio that we could predict its wavelength or frequency, and then make observations of it, we'd be able to get the motions towards or away from us right the way across the galaxy because of the potential for these radio waves to travel through the dust clouds. So away went one of the staff at the observatory, Hendrik van der Hulst, came back a little while later with his calculations saying he believed he'd worked out that there was a particular transition in the hydrogen atom relating to effectively a quantum mechanical state of the proton and the electron in the atom, where the spins were either aligned or pointing in the opposite direction, and there was a difference in energy between these two states, which if the atom flipped between the two would lead to the so-called famous hydrogen line, the 21 centimeter line, producing emission at radio wavelengths of about 21 centimeters. That line was indeed detected just a few years later, the early 1950s, by a group working in the USA. And it's since been used to make probably the best estimates we have of the structure of the Milky Way, because we're able to actually plot out the clouds of hydrogen gas that lie in the disk of the galaxy and trace out, for example, the spiral arm structure of the Milky Way. So we're fairly confident about certainly the gross features of the structure of the Milky Way now, and its spiral arm structure. Hydrogen line work in the radio has made great progress there for us. Some of the most recent work, again, working at long wavelengths, that means you're not as affected by absorption by dust. There's a great Spitzer. There's a nice image that's been made of the spiral arm structure that's come from Spitzer observations quite recently, which is worth looking at. Okay, and I think I'll just finish with just a discussion of something that came up. A project I did recently for the BBC was a little video clip which was just meant to explain some simple scientific concepts, and they asked me would I help them with a little video about the light year, In our production of that, there was a question which was from the producer there, which said, so how far away is the middle of the galaxy? How far away is the centre of the Milky Way? And I said, oh, you shouldn't ask questions like that to a scientist. Don't expect a simple answer. Sounds like a simple question. Of course, we've talked about, you know, the early observations done by Shapley and other globular clusters that gave an estimate. Probably the best estimate we have of the distance of the sun from the Milky Way center have been obtained recently by looking at the motions of stars around what we believe to be a black hole at the center of our galaxy. There's an object, it's a radio source, again using radio observations that see right through to the center, called Sagittarius A star. Sagittarius is the constellation which is at the center of the Milky Way. Sagittarius A is the brightest radio source in there, and Sagittarius A star, we believe, marks the point where this central black hole sits. And it's possible, and it's been done for a number of years now, to look at the motions of stars using various techniques. Perhaps the most famous recent examples have been using the NTT and the VLT telescopes and the Keck telescope, looking at sort of near-infrared light, measuring the positions of these stars and following their orbits over many years. So basically they've been tracking stars since about 1992, in the case of the NTT and VLT observations, since 1995 in the case of the Keck telescope observations. And what you're able to do is actually follow those stars as they orbit the Milky Way. You can plot their motions, and you can actually measure the radial velocity, so that's the speed at which the stars are moving along the line of sight, using this Doppler shift technique that we talked about earlier, the red shifts and blue shifts. And you're actually able, therefore, to get a distance to these stars and to the point at which they orbit. And the best distance that comes out of that currently is that the distance to the central black hole is about 8.3 kiloparsecs, which is about 27,000 light years. And the error on that is something like 1,000 light years. It's about 27,000 plus or minus 1,000 light years. There are other techniques. There's a very nice piece of work being done with the VLBA, the Very Long Baseline Array, which is the American Array of Radio Telescopes, spread over very large distances, so you get very high angular resolution. And there's a group that's actually looked at so-called water mazes in a star-forming region, so a region of space where there's a lot of molecules and dust and gas that's collapsing to form stars. And water molecules are producing this maser emission, very bright spots of radio light, microwave radio light. Maser is like a laser, but the M is for microwaves. And those, they can measure the positions of those spots very accurately. And over the course of a year, as the Earth moves around the Sun, you can measure their apparent position change relative to a very distant radio source outside of our galaxy, an extragalactic radio source. And we're able to measure the parallaxes, which is a direct geometric measure of distance. And again, that distance comes out with about the same, roughly, about 8 kiloparsecs, something like that. And in fact, that star forming region is known to be a little bit closer than the Sagittarius A star black hole region. So all these things are coming down on a distance to the center of the Milky Way of about something like 27,000 light years. And probably the last thing to say on this is we should look forward to a space mission that's going to do, again, it's going to revolutionise this whole field, I'm sure, called Gaia. And Gaia is a European Space Agency mission which is due to be launched in 2012. And Gaia is actually going to do a census of 1,000 million stars. In other words, a billion stars in our galaxy. And those stars are going to be monitored over a five-year period, observed many times over that period, measuring the positions and the brightness changes, and therefore, because you can measure the positions, you can get the distances from the parallax. And so we're going to get this incredible three-dimensional model of our galaxy. The specification that's quoted for Gaia is that the sort of positional accuracy to which these stars will be measured is comparable to measuring the diameter of a human hair at a distance of 1,000 kilometers. So, you know, this is incredible. And it'll provide distances accurate to about 20% at the distance of the galactic center, which is actually, you know, which is good, although, you know, actually the orbits of stars about the central black hole are more accurate than that for the distance to the central black hole. But in terms of measuring the distances to individual stars, a billion stars, it's going to be a wonderful project, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the data as that starts to come out in the next 5 years or so. Okay, if you've got any other questions, I've concentrated on Joe's question because there was a lot of things to talk about this month there. But if you have any other questions, then please send them in via the feedback form on the website.